in the United States of America. It's Free Speech Radio.
To the hour of the time, I'm William Cooper. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Well, last night you heard the first installment of a book report. And I'm not going to tell you what book it's from until it's all over. And then I'm going to tell you, and I want you to run out and get it. I want you to buy this book. I want you to make this book the greatest bestseller of all time. This is one of the treasures from my library. And when I say treasures, folks, I'm not joking. I mean it. This is one of the treasures. This is one of the most valuable books that I possess. And by value, I mean in what it contains and what it means to me. Okay? It's not going to cost you a fortune to purchase this book. It's going to cost you a few bucks, but it's not going to cost you a fortune. It's not a rare book, it's not an old book, but it is the only book, and I mean the only book that has ever told the real story from beginning to end of what really happened on April the 18th and April the 19th, 1775. And this book, the first printing, the first edition was in 1994. 5 years ago. It's been out 5 years, yet most patriots in this entire nation have never heard of it, don't know anything about it, and have never read it. So what I intend to do by doing this, and believe me, folks, I have no interest in this book other than it plucks my heartstrings. This book is what it's all about to be an American. This book is the truth about the foundations of this country. Once again, I'm not going to tell you the name of the book or the author until I finished with my book report. I began my book report in the middle of the book. In the middle of the book, actually about one-third of the way through, and I'm going to end it about one-third before the end. So you're only going to hear about one-third as a book report. I don't receive any monies from the publishers or the author. I do not know the author. I have never met anyone from this publishing company. I have no financial interest in doing this whatsoever. I have an interest in saving freedom for this nation, for my children, and for the world. And you can't save freedom if nobody knows what it is, or what it means, or how it came to be. You see, this is the only nation that has ever had a free people in the entire history of the entire world. In the entire history of the human experience, no peoples, no individuals upon the face of this earth had ever been truly free until this nation was created. Actually, until April the 19th, 1775. That's when they stood up, said no more, I'm free. Now you can better understand this story if you think of the Massachusetts colony as your city, your town, or your state, or better yet, because they were so small really back then in those days, your county. Think of the Massachusetts county where all of these things occurred as your county. Think of the Massachusetts colony where all of these events occurred as your county. think of King George as William Jefferson Clinton and Great Britain, Great Britain as Washington, D.C. This is how I want you to listen to this story. And remember, things today are much worse than they ever were then. Much, much worse. Think of General Gage. Think of General Gage as General Colin Powell, or Charlie Cashwheely, or any of those traitors who sit on the Joint Chiefs of Staff, ignoring their oath to protect and defend the Constitution for the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Think of yourselves as the colonists, the American colonists. Understand that some of you are for King George and for Great Britain, and some of you are for freedom and justice. Understand that the militia that is being demonized today is the same militia that was demonized by the English, by the King, by Great Britain in those days. And remember last night when Paul Revere rode to warn Sam Adams and John Hancock that the regulars were on the move. Remember, they were being guarded by who? By the militia. The militia. The militia. Also understand that these men were not conservatives. They were great liberals. Liberalism is the political outlook of all freedom-loving men everywhere. What you say? Understand that today's liberals are not liberals at all. They are for tyranny of big government. They're not for freedom, and therefore not liberal. They're no different from the Nazis in Germany who wanted to bring Hitler to power and control everything. Also understand that men like Pat Buchanan would not have been welcomed in the circles of the Founding Fathers. Pat Buchanan is a devout Catholic, a member of the Knights of Malta. All of the Founding Fathers were Protestants. Protestants, most were Congregationalists. They hated the Pope and the Catholic Church. I'm not telling you that you must do that today. I'm just putting everything in perspective so that you'll understand it. Last night was the first installment of this book report. Tonight is the second installment. And before it's over, you're going to become a lot more educated about the beginnings of this nation, the Founding Fathers, about freedom, about the price of freedom, than you ever dreamed that you ever could be. Liberty and justice for all.
fought and died in building this great nation. It's a pledge to fulfill our duties and obligations as citizens of the United States, to uphold the principles of our Constitution. Last but not least, it's a pledge to maintain the four great freedoms cherished by all Americans: freedom of speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America, to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty
that evening, while Paul Revere and William Dawes were preparing to leave Boston, General Gage set his army in motion. Many precautions were taken to prevent discovery. The soldiers were awakened in their beds, sergeants putting their hands on them and whispering gently to them. The men dressed quietly, strapped on their full cartridge boxes, and picked up their heavy muskets. They were ordered to leave their knapsacks behind and to carry one day's provisions in their haversacks. One soldier remembered that he was told to bring 36 rounds of powder and ball. The British soldiers were conducted by a back way out of their barracks, without the knowledge of their comrades and without the observation of the sentries. The men were ordered to move in small parties so as not to alarm the town. They walked through the street with the utmost silence. It being about 10 o'clock, no sound was heard but of their feet. A dog that happened to bark was instantly killed with a bayonet. The regulars made their way to a rendezvous, chosen for its remoteness. An empty beach on the edge of the Back Bay near Boston's new powder house in the most unfrequented part of town. When challenged by the sentries, they answered with the evening's countersign: patrol. First to arrive were the flank companies of the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. Their regiment adjutant, Frederick Mackenzie, regarding punctuality as a point of honor. Next came the King's Own, who bivouacked near Boston Common, close by the beach. Other companies came in from Fort Hill, and some from Boston Neck, and a few from the warehouse barracks near Long Wharf. Several companies arrived from the North End after forming up near the North Church. They were the troops who had nearly intercepted Robert Millen and Captain Foley. Altogether, the expedition numbered between 800 and 900 regulars in 21 companies, plus a few volunteers and loyalist guides. These were picked men. Picked men, the flower of General Gage's army. In that era, most regiments of British infantry had two elite units, a grenadier company and a light infantry company. The grenadiers were big men, chosen for size and strength. In the earlier 18th century, their special task had been to hurl heavy hand grenades at the enemy, hence their name and stature. By 1775, they had lost that role and gained another, as shock troops, whose mission was to lead the bloody assaults that shattered an enemy line or captured a fortification by a coup de main. The light infantry companies were a different elite, the most agile and active men, selected for fitness, energy, and enterprise. They had been added to every British regiment in 1771 to serve as skirmishers and flank guards, partly at the urging of General Gage. In some regiments, These men carried long-barreled muskets, which were more accurate at longer distances than the standard issue Tower musket. Some were equipped with hatchets modeled on American tomahawks. In the French and Indian War, British commanders had sometimes collected their light infantry and grenadier companies into provisional units for special service. General Gage followed this common procedure. His Concord expedition consisted of 11 companies of grenadiers and 10 of light infantry. That practice had the advantage of bringing together the best soldiers in the army, but it also had a major weakness. Officers and men of different regiments were not used to working with one another. They found themselves commanded by strangers and compelled to fight alongside other units whom they did not know or trust. The regimental spirit that was carefully cultivated in the British Army worked against the cohesion of ad hoc units. Further, the normal chain of command was broken above the company level, and the complex evolutions of 18th century warfare sometimes dissolved in confusion. That confusion began to appear in the first moments of the Concord expedition when the companies came together on Boston's Back Bay. The 23rd's regimental adjutant, Frederick McKenzie, was appalled by the disorder he met on the beach. He found no officer of high rank firmly in command of the embarkation, and separate companies struggling aimlessly. The junior officers had been told nothing about where they were going or what they were to do. Lieutenant Barker of the 4th King's Own wrote, "Few but the commanding officers knew what the expedition we were going upon." The Navy was there in good time, but McKenzie counted only 20 ships' boats, not nearly enough to carry the entire force in a single crossing. Two trips were needed to move everyone across the water. McKenzie peered across the dark river toward the opposite shore and discovered still another problem that had not been anticipated. General Gage's staff had selected the crossing point mainly for secrecy. It ran from the most secluded spot in Boston across the Back Bay to a lonely beach on Lechmere Point in Cambridge, inhabited only by a single isolated farmstead known as the Phipps Farm. The bay was broad and shallow at that point. The boat's crews had to run more than a mile in a diagonal downstream course against a rising spring tide that was flowing up the Charles Estuary. The Navy's longboats were clumsy, heavy craft built for strength and stability in the open sea. They were ordered to be tied together, bow to stern, in strings of three or four. That precaution was thought necessary to keep coxswains from losing their way in the dark, but it made the crossing even slower when speed was vital to success. The soldiers were packed into the boat so tightly that there was no room to sit down. The vessels settled deep in the water until their gunwales were nearly awash. In the center of each boat, the men stood quietly, their red coats nearly black in the moonlight and their long muskets slanting upward toward the bright sky. On the stern sheets, beardless midshipmen whispered commands to weather-beaten seamen while heavy ash oars creaked rhythmically against sturdy locust thole pins. As the boats approached Lechmere Point, they went aground in shallow water that was nearly knee-deep. The soldiers climbed into the river and waded awkwardly ashore, muskets held at high port. Then the boats backed off and returned for another load. It was slow and painful work. Not until midnight was every man landed. 2 precious hours had been spent crossing the Charles River. On the Cambridge shore, there was another scene of confusion as officers and sergeants struggled to form their broken companies. The commander, Lieutenant Colonel Francis Smith, looked on with horror at the disorder that surrounded him. He was what another army, in a later time, would call a book soldier. Methodical, cautious, and careful. An officer much to General Gage's liking. That night, When time was of the essence, Colonel Smith ordered each company to assemble in a predetermined order on the beach. First came the light infantry of his own 10th Foot, then the other companies of light infantry in order of their regimental number, and the heavy grenadiers in the same sequence. This tidy arrangement was not Colonel Smith's private obsession. It was a point of regimental pride in the British Army. A regiment's number indicated its seniority. The 4th King's Own Foot had the lowest number that night, then the 5th, and others in numerical order. More time was lost as units jerked back and forth trying to find their place in the line. At last, every company was in its proper place and the men were ordered to march. They advanced painfully in their soggy gaiters and square-toed shoes full of brackish river water. As they left the beach, the men discovered, to their surprise, that they had been landed squarely in the middle of the marshes of Cambridge. Their landing zone was sparsely inhabited because it was a swamp. The men tried to move along the river's edge, where the footing seemed more solid than in the swamp itself. But the slippery beach pebbles were treacherous underfoot, and the thick river mud sucked at their heavy shoes. The tide was still high. From time to time, the column found itself plunging into the water again. One officer recalled that their route took them at first through some swamps and slips of the sea, and they were obliged to wade halfway up their thighs through two inlets. Lieutenant Barker was one of the lucky ones. He remembered that his company was wet nearly to our knees. Another officer recalled that his men were soaked up to their middles. But at last they came to a rough farm track that ran through the marsh. The road, to be sure, was soft and wet, but at least it resembled terra firma. Here, Colonel Smith halted his men yet again while he waited for the Navy to deliver 2 days' provisions that had been prepared aboard ships in the harbor to avoid discovery. The regulars stood quietly in the mud with the fatalism that is part of every soldier's life, while sergeants prowled restlessly through the ranks. They were making sure that every infantryman had 36 rounds and a full cartridge box. The men, wet, were increasingly miserable. It was not a cold night by New England standards, but the men were sopping wet all the way through, and a chill wind was blowing. They began to tremble in their wet uniforms, which were uncomfortable enough even when they were dry. You see, the uniform of the British soldier in 1775 might have been designed by some ironic tailor who had sworn sartorial vengeance upon the human frame. The grenadiers wore towering caps of bearskin, later coonskin, or fusiliers, adorned with heavy metal faceplates and colorful cords and tassels, and blazoned at the back with their regimental number in large Roman letters. Their headgear was designed partly to allow muskets to be slung easily, but its major purpose was to magnify the height of the men who wore them. On active service, the caps were awkward and top-heavy. They were also costly to replace and had to be protected in the field with painted canvas covers, caps for caps, which were slung from a belt when not in use. Some long-forgotten British officer had thought that the extended height of the British troops would scare the enemy on the battlefield. The light infantry wore tight helmets of black leather adorned with feathers or horsehair crests and constructed with whimsical peaks in front or behind, according to the fancy of the regimental commander. Now, this headgear, to be sure, was less awkward than the bearskins of the grenadiers, but it offered little protection against the rain, intended to crack in the sun. When wet, the leather shrank painfully, gripping the head of the soldier like a vice. The ordinary rank and file were called hat company after their standard issue cocked hats. According to the prevailing fashion in 1775, they were worn too small to fit snugly around the crown and merely perched on top of the head. To keep them from tumbling off, the hats had to be fastened to the hair by tapes and hooks and eyes. The hair itself was dressed according to the taste of each colonel. In some regiments, it was powdered white. In others, it was congealed with gleaming black grease. Mostly, it was clubbed into a long plait or pigtail, doubled on itself, and tied neatly with ribbon. Bald men, and even those with thinning hair, were required to wear switches. The neck was swathed in tight stocks of horsehair or velvet that came nearly to the chin. These men who stood that night in the muddy marshes of Cambridge wore snow-white linen that had been changed only the day before. Every Wednesday and Sunday, fresh linen was put on throughout the British Army. They also were issued white or buff-colored waistcoats and breeches, which were ordered to be kept immaculate on pain of a flogging. Later in the war, British soldiers were allowed to wear coveralls or loose trousers on active service. The most distinctive part of the uniform was the heavy red coat. For grenadiers and line companies, this was a garment with long tails that descended nearly to the knee. The light infantry wore short jackets that ended at the hip and were much preferred on active service. Later in the Revolution, General John Burgoyne ordered all his men to cut down their coats into jackets. Contemporary illustrations commonly show that the red coats of 1775 were worn very tight, according to the 18th century fashion. They were supposed to be pre-shrunk, but after exposure to rain, they shrank again, sometimes so much that the men found it painful to move their arms. Both coats and jackets were made of a coarse red woolen fabric that was strong and densely woven and meant to stand hard service. After the battle, Dover militiaman Jabez Baker carried home one of these red coats as a souvenir. In the New England way, it was put to work as a scarecrow in the fields. So sturdy was its cloth that it was still in service as late as 1866. A tattered survivor of 90 New England winters and an impressive testament to the durability of its sturdy British cloth. The red coats were elaborately embellished with lace, wings, buttons, loops, knots, and incongruous heart-shaped margins on the coattails. Lapels and cuffs were turned to reveal contrasting facings of the regimental color. Royal regiments proudly wore facings of a rich dark blue, the original royal blue. Men from three royal regiments were standing in the Cambridge swamp this night. The King's On, the Royal Irish, and the Royal Welsh Fusiliers. Other regiments had facings of buff, the 52nd, pale yellow, the 38th, or off-white, the 47th. Lord Percy's 5th Foot, soon to be the Northumberland Fusiliers, was elegant in facings of gosling green. The 59th, lighter, the East Lancashire Regiment, was resplendent in bright purple. The 10th, afterwards the Lincolnshire Regiment, was gaudy in an exceptionally vivid yellow. A few men on detached duty from the 64th, subsequently the Prince of Wales North Staffordshire Regiment, wore facings of sinister black. The Royal Marines were made to wear snow-white facings, which caused the men much trouble in the field. Their commander, Major Pitcairn, wrote home to a friend in the Admiralty, "I every day wish for any lapels but white. I wish his lordship would give us blue, green, or black." Drummers and fifers, of whom 39 were attached to the army units in the expedition, wore coats of the same color as the facings of their regiments, except in royal regiments, and bright red breeches, linings, and vests. Their sleeves were heavily adorned with lace, as the colonel shall think fit. often in thick white chevrons from wrist to shoulder, to make them highly visible on a field of battle, where they had a vital function in command and control. In every regiment, equipment was suspended from white cross belts, a broad belt over the left shoulder to support the cartridge box, a narrow belt over the right shoulder for a long sword, and a waist belt for the bayonet and short sword. The belts were kept immaculate by frequent rubbing with pipe clay, a ritual for many generations in the British Army. The light infantry wore tan or black leather belts, which were less visible and much more practical. The grenadiers on the Concord expedition were probably still wearing their winter gaiters of black heavy linen, which covered the legs from ankle to thigh and were secured below the knee with black garters so tight as to threaten the circulation. For durability, the gaiters had hard leather tops that chafed the upper legs so severely that white linen knee cuffs were added to cushion them. The light infantry wore short gaiters that offered more comfort but less protection. Transpiring on the night of April the 18th, 1775, you all must remember that Paul Revere was not carrying out the mission that children have been taught for many years in the history of this country. His mission was not to warn the militia. His mission was not to warn the countryside. His mission was to warn Samuel Adams and John Hancock at the Clark home. And that was the extent of his mission. William Dawes was also sent, and at least two other unknown messengers were sent that night on the exact same mission to make sure that Sam Adams and John Hancock, two very important founding fathers, were warned so that they could maintain their freedom and safety. After they reached the Clark home, they were then given instructions by Sam Adams and John Hancock to ride off and warn the citizens of Concord that they believed that the mission of the regulars was to seize the stores at Concord, the stores being the powder and arms of the colonists. There were, on that night, riding through the countryside on missions of their own, completely unknown to Dr. Warren, Samuel Adams, and John Hancock, and Paul Revere and William Dawes, I might add, at least 60 men and women whose mission was to warn the militia. And the citizens in the farms and the villages along the route to Lexington and Concord. And this they did very well. Not one of them ever yelled, the British are coming. Not one of them ever yelled, the redcoats are coming. For they were all British themselves and considered them to be loyal subjects. It wasn't until after the next day that they had any inkling of an idea of a separation from their mother country. And with that in your mind, we will continue with our story. The most bizarre part of this infantry uniform was the footwear. In 1775, British regiments called foot did not wear right and left shoes, but heavy interchangeable square-toed bogans that were reversed every day to keep them from running crooked. The men of the Concord expedition would be asked to march 40 miles in that unforgiving footgear. Their special marching socks were made of linen and soaked in oil to shed water. For this campaign, the historian of the King's Own notes that, "For the first time we hear that the private soldiers wore underclothes, a pair of linen drawers being included in the list of necessities." Officers' uniforms displayed many differences of social rank. Their coats were not red, but scarlet, a distinction that continues today in the dress uniforms of some British regiments. The costly scarlet dye, prepared from the dried bodies of female cottonwood insects, preserved its color long after the cheaper redcoats of the rank and file had faded to a dusty rose. In the field, the brilliant scarlet tunics of the officers stood out at long distance from the brownish pink of the rank and file, a dubious honor in America, where unsporting Yankee marksmen went methodically about the business of killing the officers first. And modern militiamen should learn from that. Every article of dress became an emblem of rank. The men were given breeches of coarse white linen. Officers on active service wore elegant small clothes of white leather. The uniform coats of the rank and file were embellished with lace of worsted woolen thread. Their officers were adorned with lace of gilt or silver. Men wore a simple black stock around their necks. Officers added a ceremonial gorget, which was a vestigial relic of medieval armor. A crescent shaped piece of metal, either silver or gilt, to match the buttons of the regiment, embellished with the royal arms, engraved with the regimental number, and suspended from a silk ribbon or a silver chain. Its highly polished surface sparkled in the light and made a perfect aiming point just below the throat. The men wore on their hips a gray canvas haversack prominently marked with the king's broad arrow, and in some regiments a small canteen. Old soldiers sometimes marched with two canteens, one for water, the other for Yankee rum, which may have been passed eagerly from mouth to mouth as they stood in the cold Cambridge marshes. Lord Percy himself carried a flask of fine French brandy. The regulars waited miserably in their wet uniforms for another hour, until at last their provisions were delivered by the Navy. The Army looked with disdain on Navy rations, of which the staple was rock-hard ship's biscuit, often crawling with white maggots. An officer of the 23rd remembered that his fusiliers threw away the Navy food in disgust, having brought their own Army rations with them. Finally, about 2 o'clock in the morning, a full 4 hours after leaving barracks in Boston, Colonel Smith ordered his column forward. To escape the marshes, it was necessary to double back nearly a mile to the east on a farm road that curved around the northeastern side of a low hill. Just as the men were beginning to dry out, they came to a little stream called Willis Creek that flowed into the back bay. A wooden bridge spanned the water, but Colonel Smith feared that the heavy tramp of army shoes would wake the sleeping countryside. So he ordered his men off the road and sent them sliding down a slippery mud embankment into a swirling stream that was frigid with melted snow. Lieutenant Barker vividly remembered the sensation of wading through a very long ford up to our middles. The men were now shaking with cold, in addition to being thoroughly wet. They formed up once again on the other side of the little stream and resumed the march. Steadily, they advanced along the country roads past silent houses, sleeping in the moonlight. Most of the soldiers still did not know where they were going or what they were asked to do. Even the company commanders had not been told the purpose of their mission. The men were wet, cold, and now getting numb. Few had slept since British column. Few had slept since the night before. Many were hungry and thirsty and had already drained their canteens. Some began to break ranks to drink from wells along the road. At least one soldier dropped out altogether and went to the lonely farmhouse on Lechmere Point. The family took him in, learned about the expedition, and sent word into town. Those in town quickly dispatched riders to warn the countryside. The regulars continued on through Cambridge, following a road that curved around the north end of town. They passed Piper's Tavern in what is now Union Square, Somerville. An inhabitant saw them go by and heard the soldiers repeat the name on the signboard, which they could read in the bright moonlight. We think of our ancestors as early sleepers and early risers, but a remarkably large number were up and about in the small hours of that April night. In East Cambridge, the widow, Elizabeth Rand, was wide awake. The day before, a hog had been butchered for her use. The carcass was hanging outside her house, and she worried that a thief might steal it from the night. About 2:30, she heard a strange noise and rushed outside in her nightgown to protect her property. To her amazement, she saw 800 men marching silently toward her house. The little man dodged behind a rain barrel and kept out of sight until the soldiers were gone. Then, she tucked up her nightdress and sprinted to the home of her neighbor, Samuel Tufts, who also was awake, hard at work with a sign pouring lead into a bullet mold. Both men were so busy that they did not hear the regulars go by. Tufts listened incredulously to the widow's story and refused to believe a word of it. She led him to the road and, with the aid of a lantern, showed him the square shoe prints in the ground. Samuel Tufts was persuaded. He saddled his horse and rode off to spread the word. How many of you have ever heard of Samuel Tufts? Are the widow, Elizabeth Rand? Are any of the other 60 or so men and women who worked diligently and rode off into the night to warn their countrymen? The British regulars continued west through Cambridge to the Great Road, now Massachusetts Avenue, that led to Lexington and Concord. As they turned onto the highway at the present site of Porter Square, the British vanguard saw two countrymen coming toward them in a wagon. Thomas Robbins and David Harrington of Lexington were taking a load of milk to market in Boston. They saw the British column at a distance, pulled off the road, and were working frantically to unhitch their horses when the regulars were upon them. The two Lexington men were taken prisoner and made to march with the column. The horses were given to British officers. The column crossed a little stream, now called Alewife Park, and entered the village of Menotomy. In a house by the road, a man opened his door and watched the column go by. A thirsty soldier left the ranks and asked for a drink of water. The householder, Lieutenant Solomon Bowman of the town's militia, asked the British regular, "What are you out at this time of night for?" The soldier made no reply and was sent on his way. Bowman went off to muster his company of militia. In Menotomy, the column passed the Black Horse Tavern, where the Committee of Safety had been meeting that day. Three Whig leaders, Colonel Jeremiah Lane, Colonel Azor Orne, and Eldridge Gerry, were staying the night. The landlord saw a party of regulars turn off the road toward the tavern and cried, "For God's sake, don't open the door!" As the soldiers approached the front of the inn, the Whig leaders dashed out the back door, right over the heels, lying flat on the wet ground behind a low stubble of last year's corn stalks. Thank God they were not discovered. Farther on, a party of young men were playing cards in a shop by the road. They heard the soldiers and went to warn others. They joined the legion of men and women riding through the night. At the Tufts Tavern in Menotomy, the innkeeper was awake and toiling at his endless chores. He looked out and saw several regulars moving toward his barn, where he kept a handsome white horse. The Yankee innkeeper ran to intercept them and said to an officer, "You are taking an early ride, sir." The regular replied, "You'd better get to bed and get your sleep while you can," and left without the horse. At a place called Foot of Rocks, near today's Forest Street, the British column passed a house where a light was burning. They knocked on the door and were told by a woman that her old man was ill and she was brewing him a pot of herb tea. In fact, she and her husband, who was hale and hearty, had been busy melting their pewter dishes into bullets. The next house, now 21 Appleton Street, Arlington, belonged to Menotomy's militia captain, Benjamin Locke. He also heard the column march past and instantly set himself to rousing his neighbors. The leaders of the British expedition were increasingly concerned. They had been driving their men, hoping to make up the vital hours that had been lost in the Cambridge marshes. The column made remarkable time, a mile every 16 minutes. A rapid clip for a night march in close order on a dark and muddy road. An officer noted that the pace was hasty and fatiguing. But their commander was not pleased with their progress. Colonel Francis Smith was by nature a worrying sort of man. He worried about the late start and the early dawn that was now only a few hours away. Most of all, he worried about the bridges at Concord. What if the New England militia reached the bridges first? What if the New England militia reached the bridges first? He might have to fight the peasants, as he calls them, a retreat as Colonel Leslie had done at Salem. As the main body of the column moved into the village of Menotomy, Smith's worries got the better of him. He halted his command, gave the men a short rest, and summoned his second in command, Major John Pitcairn of the Royal Marines. Pitcairn was ordered to take the six leading companies of light infantry and advance at the quick march to Concord. There he was told to seize the bridges north and south of the town and hold them until the grenadiers came up. Pitcairn, a good officer, set off in stride, leading his six light companies at a rapid rate. To set the pace, he put one of his best men at the head of the column, Lieutenant Jesse Adair, a hard-charging young Marine who could be trusted to keep the column moving. With Adair in the van was a New England Tory named Daniel Murray, who had graduated from Harvard only 3 years before. He often tramped the roads between the college in Cambridge and his home in Worcester County, where his prominent family was much hated for their loyalist sympathies. Later, his three brothers would take up arms for King and Empire. Also at the head of the column were several unattached officers, Lieutenant William Sutherland of the 38th Foot and Surgeons Nate Sims of the 43rd Foot. Behind them came an advance party of foot-like infantrymen, among them Private James Moore of the King's Own, a Scot whose speech carried a strong Aberdeen burr. The hour was now near 4 a.m. Suddenly, the quiet of the night was broken by the heavy sound of hoofbeats from the west. In the vanguard of Pitcairn's advance force, a boy whispered to Lieutenant Sutherland and the Tory guide Daniel Murray, "Here are two fellows galloping express to alarm the country." As the horsemen approached, Sutherland leaped out of the shadows and seized the bridle of one horse, while Murray grabbed the other. Both riders were turned out of their saddles, and the horses were taken by the officers. The captives were Asahel Porter and Josiah Richardson of Woburn. They were made to march with the column on pain of death. The regulars became highly skilled at the art of snaring Yankees on the road. Two light infantrymen were posted well ahead in the shadows on either side of the highway. When a rider approached, they allowed him to pass, then rose and closed upon him from the rear, while others stopped him from the front. 2.5 miles of Lexington, the British vanguard captured an angry young man named Simon Winship. He was returning to his father's house, peaceable and unarmed, and was ordered to dismount. At 4 o'clock in the morning, he gave the regulars a defiant lecture on liberty, demanding to know by what right they had stopped him in the public road. At gunpoint, he was pulled off his horse and put with the other prisoner. The column left more horsemen. It began to hear signal guns and alarm bells ahead and even behind. Colonel Smith halted the grenadiers and ordered an aide to ride back to Boston with a message that surprise had been lost and reinforcements might be necessary. The British courier galloped away into the night. The column resumed its long march, moving deeper into the dark and hostile countryside. While the British column was beginning its march through Cambridge, Earl Revere and William Dawes traveled out of Lexington on their second mission of the night. As they headed west toward Concord, they were overtaken on the road by a handsome young country gentleman, splendidly mounted and elegantly dressed. He introduced himself as Dr. Samuel Prescott, a physician of Concord. Young Dr. Prescott had other things on his mind than politics or war that night. He had been in Lexington courting Miss Lydia Mulliken, a young woman much celebrated in Middlesex County for her grace and beauty. Many a hopeful swain had beaten the path to the Mulliken door, but Miss Lydia had pledged herself to Dr. Prescott, and they had agreed to be married. It was about 1 o'clock in the morning when Dr. Prescott said farewell to his fiancée and started home to Concord. He met Paul Revere and William Dawes and rode along beside them. They found the congenial young doctor to be a high son of liberty and explained their mission to him. He instantly offered to help alarm the countryside. Paul Revere proposed a plan. As always, he was thinking several steps ahead and preparing for the worst case. He told Dawes and Prescott about the roving British patrols and warned them that they might expect to be captured. I told them of the 10 officers that Mr. Bartlett's met, he wrote later, and that it was probable we might be stopped before we got to Conger. I likewise mentioned that we had better alarm all the inhabitants till we got to Conger. The others accepted his plan. Well, Bear remembered that the young doctor much approved of it and said he would stop with either of us, for the people between that place and Concord knew him and would give the more credit to what we said. The three riders decided to alarm every house, taking turns from one farmstead to the next. Knowing that British patrols were abroad in the night, they urged others to help spread the warning. Working together, they made rapid progress through the western part of Lexington. 2 miles beyond Lexington Green, they entered the town of Lincoln, a new community that had been created only 20 years before. Paul Revere reckoned they had come about halfway from Lexington to Concord. Here, the great road curved westward through open fields and pastures, interspersed with patches of swamp and woodland. Very near the boundary between Lincoln and Lexington, the road ran past a little cluster of farmsteads, 3 or 4 of them a few hundred feet apart. Each house was set only a few feet from the north edge of the highway, facing south toward the ramp of the sun. According to the Yankee custom, all were occupied by families called Nelson. This pattern of settlement was typical of old New England. It was the custom for sons to settle close to their father's land while the daughters moved away. As a consequence, many town centers in Massachusetts were surrounded by small hamlets of households with the same surname. Good night, folks. God bless each and every single one of you. Good night, Annie, my dear, dear wife, and Pooh and Allison. I love you. More than you will ever know.
If tomorrow all the things were gone, work for all my life, and I had to start a plan, just my children and my wife. Thank my lucky stars, we're here today. The flag still stands for freedom, and they can't take that away. And I'm proud to be an American.
Ladies and gentlemen, seek out and join a militia, or form a militia in your community. Your freedoms are in danger as never before. The founders never faced a more dreadful enemy than we face today. And if we wish to live in freedom, if we wish our children to live in freedom and enjoy the same opportunities that we have had because of the sacrifices of the Founding Fathers, then you must be prepared to fight and die for freedom. You will be asked to stand up sometime in the very near future, or to become a slave in the totalitarian socialist New World Order. Every person must make a choice. Make yours now.
Next to you and defend her till the day. But there ain't no doubt I love this man. God bless the USA.
WB.
WBCQ, Monticello, Maine, USA.
One.